Chapter 8. The two Primarchs wasted no time in convening the senior officers of the legions in the Heliopolis to discuss strategy for the destruction of the Diasporex. The marble benches nearest the dark floor were filled with the purple and gold of the Emperor's children and the black and white of the Iron Hands. So far, the Council of War was not going well, and Julius could see the choler rising in Ferus Manus as Fulgrim dismissed his latest idea as unworkable.
"Then what do you propose, brother? For I have no more stratagems to suggest," said the Primarch of the Iron Hands. "As soon as we threaten them, they flee."
Fulgrim turned to face Ferus Manus and said, "Do not mistake what I say as criticism, brother. I am merely stating what I see as fundamental to the reason why you have not yet managed to bring the Diasporex to battle."
"Which is?"
"That you are being too direct."
"Too direct?" asked Ferus Manus,
but Fulgrim held up a quieting hand to forestall any further outbursts. "I know you, brother, and I know the way your legion fights, but sometimes chasing the comet's tail is not the best way to catch it."
"You would have us skulk around this sector like thieves while we wait for them to come to us? The Iron Hands do not make war that way."
Fulgrim shook his head. "Do not think for a moment that I am unaware of the simple joy to be had in going up the centre, but we must be prepared to accept that other ways may advance our cause more perfectly." Fulgrim walked the circumference of the Heliopolis as he spoke, directing his words to his fellow Primarch and the warriors who surrounded him. Reflected light from the ceiling lit his face from below, and his eyes, a dark mirror of Ferus Manus's silver ones, were alight with passion as he spoke.
"You have become fixated on destroying the Diasporex, Ferus, which is only right and proper given their associations with vile aliens, but you have not asked yourself the most important question regarding this enemy."
Ferus Manus crossed his arms and said,
"And what question would that be?"
Fulgrim smiled.
"Why are they here?"
"You wish to get into a philosophical debate?" snapped Ferus Manus. "Then speak to the iterators. I'm sure they can furnish you with a better, less direct answer than I."
Fulgrim turned to address the warriors of the two legions and said,
"Ask yourselves this, then. Knowing that a powerful fleet of warships is hunting you and seeks your destruction, why would you not simply leave? Why would you not move on to somewhere safer?"
"I do not know, brother," said Ferus Manus. "Why?"
Julius felt his Primarch's gaze upon him, and the weight of expectation crushed him to his seat. If the intellect of a Primarch could not answer this question, what chance did he have? He looked into Fulgrim's eyes, seeing his lord's faith, and the answer was suddenly clear. Julius stood and said,
"Because they can't. They're trapped in this system."
"Trapped?" asked Gabriel Santar from across the chamber. "Trapped? How?"
"I don't know," said Julius. "Perhaps they have no navigator."
"No," said Fulgrim, "that's not it. If they were without a navigator, then the 52nd expedition would have caught them long ago. It's something else."
"What?"
Julius watched as the officers of both legions contemplated the question, sure that his Primarch already knew the answer. Even as the answer came to him, Gabriel Santar stood and said,
"Fuel! They need fuel for their fleet."
Though Julius knew it was foolish, he felt a stab of jealousy at being denied the chance to answer his Primarch and glared angrily at the weathered face of the Iron Hand's first captain.
"Exactly," said Fulgrim.
"Fuel! A fleet the size of the Diasporex must consume a phenomenal amount of energy every day, and to make a jump of any distance they will need a great deal of it. The fleet masters of this sector's compliant worlds do not report any significant losses of tankers or convoys, so we must assume the Diasporex are getting their fuel from another source."
"The Carolus Star," said Julius. "They must have solar collectors hidden somewhere in the sun's corona. They're waiting to gather enough fuel before moving on."
Fulgrim turned back to the centre of the chamber and said,
That is how we will bring the Diasporex to battle, by discovering these collectors and threatening them. We will draw our enemies to a battle of our choosing, and then we will destroy them.
Later, after the War Council had disbanded, Fulgrim and Ferus Manus retired to the Lord of the Emperor's Children's private staterooms aboard the Pride of the Emperor. Fulgrim's chambers were the envy of Terra's Master of Antiquities. Every wall hung with elegantly framed pictures of vibrant alien landscapes or extraordinary Picts of the Astartes and mortals of the Crusade. Antechambers filled with marble busts and the spoils of war radiated from the central stateroom, and everywhere the eye fell, it alighted on a work of unimaginable artistic beauty. Only the far end of the room was bare of ornamentation, the space filled with part-carved blocks of marble and easels of unfinished artwork. Fulgrim reclined on a chaise longue, stripped out of his armour and dressed in a simple toga of cream and purple. He drank wine from a crystal goblet and rested his hand on a table upon which lay the silver-hilted sword he had taken from the Lair Temple. The sword was a truly magnificent weapon, hardly the equal of Fireblade, but exquisite nonetheless. Its balance was flawless, as though it had been designed for his hand alone, and its keen edge had the power to cut through Astarte's plate with ease. The purple gem at the pommel was of crude workmanship, but had a certain primitive charm to it that was quite at odds with the quality of the blade and hilt. Perhaps he would replace the gem with something more appropriate. Even as the thought arose, he dismissed it, feeling suddenly as though such an exchange would be the basest act of vandalism. With a shake of his head, Fulgrim put the sword from his mind and ran a hand through his unbound white hair. Ferus Manus paced the room like a caged lion, and though scout ships were even now hunting the Diasporex fuel collectors, he still chafed at this enforced inaction.
"Oh, sit down, Ferus," said Fulgrim. "You will wear a groove in the marble. Take some wine."
"Sometimes, Fulgrim, I swear this isn't a ship of war any more. It's a flying gallery," said Ferus Manus, examining the works hung on the walls. "Although these Picts are good, who took them?"
"An imagist named Euphrati Keeler. I'm told she travels with the 63rd expedition."
"She has a fine eye," noted Ferus. "These are good Picts."
"Yes," said Fulgrim. "I suspect that her name will be known throughout the expedition fleet soon."
"Although I'm not sure about these paintings," said Ferus, pointing at a series of abstract acrylics of riotous colour and passionate brushstrokes.
"You have no appreciation of the finer things, my brother," sighed Fulgrim. "Those are works by Serena D'Angelus. Noble families of Terra would pay a small fortune to own such a piece."
"Really?" said Ferus, tilting his head to one side. "What are they supposed to be?"
"They are,"
began Fulgrim, struggling to put into words the sensations and emotions evoked by the colours and shapes within the picture. He looked closely at the picture and smiled.
"They are recreations of reality, formed according to the artist's metaphysical value judgments," he said,
the words leaping unbidden to his lips.
"An artist recreates those aspects of reality that represent the fundamental truth of man's nature. To understand that is to understand the truth of the galaxy. Mistress D'Angelus is aboard the Pride of the Emperor. I should introduce you to her."
Ferus grunted and asked,
"Why do you insist on keeping such things around? They are a distraction from our duty to the Emperor and Horus."
Fulgrim shook his head.
"These works will be the Emperor's children's lasting contribution to a compliant galaxy. Yes, there are planets yet to conquer and enemies yet to defeat, but what manner of galaxy will it be if there are none to appreciate what has been won? The Imperium will be a hollow place if it is to be denied art, poetry and music, and those with the wit to appreciate them. Art and beauty are as close to the divine as we find in this godless age.
People should, in their daily lives, aspire to create art and beauty. That will be what the Imperium comes to stand for in time, and it will make us immortal.
I still think it's a distraction, said Ferus Manus.
Not at all, Ferus, for the foundations of the Imperium are art and science. Remove them or degrade them, and the Imperium is no more. It is said that empire follows art, and not vice versa, as those of a more prosaic nature might suppose, and I would rather go without food or water for weeks than go without art.
Ferus looked unconvinced, and pointed to the unfinished works that lay at the far end of the stateroom.
So what are these ones, then? They're not very good. What do they recreate?
Fulgrim felt a flush of anger, but suppressed it before it could show.
I was indulging my creative side, but it is nothing serious, he said,
a traitorous kernel within him seething at his handiwork being dismissed so lightly. Ferus Manus shrugged and sat on a tall wooden chair before pouring himself a chalice of wine from a silver amphora.
"Ah, it's good to be back amongst friends," said Ferus Manus, raising his chalice.
"That it is," agreed Fulgrim. "We see too little of one another now that the Emperor has returned to Terra."
"And taken the fists with him," said Ferus.
"I had heard," said Fulgrim. "Has Dawn done something to offend our father?"
Ferus Manus shook his head.
"Not that I'm aware of, but who knows? Perhaps Horus was told."
You should really try to get into the habit of calling him the War Master now.
I know, said Ferus, but I still find it hard to think of Horus that way, you understand?
I do, but it is the way of things, brother, pointed out Fulgrim. Horus is War Master, and we are his generals. War Master Horus commands, and we obey.
You're right, of course. He's earned it. I'll give him that, said Ferus, raising his chalice. No one has a greater tally of victories than the Lunar Wolves. Horus deserves our loyalty.
Spoken like a true follower,
smiled Fulgrim, an inner voice goading him into baiting his brother Primarch.
What's that supposed to mean?
Nothing, said Fulgrim, with a shake of his hand. Come on, didn't you hope it would be you? Didn't you wish with all your heart that the Emperor would name you his regent?
Ferus shook his head emphatically.
No.
No.
I can honestly say that I didn't, said Ferus, draining his chalice and pouring another. Can you imagine the weight of the responsibility? We've come this far with the Emperor at our head, but I can't even begin to conceive of the ambition that it must have taken to lead a crusade in conquest of the galaxy.
So you don't think Horus is up to it? Asked Fulgrim.
Not at all, chuckled Ferus. And don't put words in my mouth, brother. I won't be branded a traitor for failing to support Horus. If any of us can be War Master, I'd expect it to be Horus.
Not everyone thinks so.
You've been talking to Perturabo and Angron, haven't you?
Amongst others, admitted Fulgrim. They communicated their disquiet at the Emperor's decision.
No matter who was chosen, they would have raged against it, said Ferus.
Probably, agreed Fulgrim, but I am glad it was Horus. He will achieve great things.
I'll drink to that, said Ferus, draining his chalice.
He is a sycophant and easily swayed, said a voice in his head, and Fulgrim blinked at the force of it.
With the end of the war on Laren, the steady stream of wounded and dead to the Apothecarian had slowed, leaving Fabius more time to devote to his researches. To ensure the secrecy his experiments demanded, he had relocated to a little-used research facility aboard the Andronius, a strike cruiser under the authority of Lord Commander Eidolon. Its facilities had been basic at first, but with Eidolon's blessing, he had gathered a bewildering array of specialist equipment. Eidolon himself had escorted him to the facility, marching along the length of the gallery of swords to the forward starboard apothecarium, its brushed steel walls gleaming and sterile. Without pause, Eidolon had led him through the circular hub of the main laboratory and along a tiled corridor to a gilded vestibule where two corridors branched left and right. The wall before them was blank, though there were indications that there was soon to be something placed upon it, a mosaic or bas-relief.
"Why are we here?" Fabius had asked.
"You will see," said Eidolon, reaching out to press a portion of the wall, whereupon it had arced upwards to reveal a glowing passageway and a spiral staircase. They had descended into a research facility, surgical tables covered with white sheets and incubation tanks lying dormant and empty.
"This is where you will work," declared Eidolon. "The Primarch has placed a heavy burden on you, Apothecary, and you will not fail."
"I will not," agreed Fabius. "But tell me, Lord Commander, why do you take such a personal interest in my labours?"
Eidolon's eyes had narrowed, and he had fixed Fabius with a baleful glare.
"I am to take the Proud Heart to the Satyr Lanxus belt on a peacekeeping mission."
"An inglorious but necessary duty to ensure that the imperial governors are maintaining the lawful rule of the Emperor," said Fabius, though he had known full well that Eidolon would not see it that way.
"It is shameful," snapped Eidolon. "It is a waste of my skill and courage that I should be sent away from the fleet like this."
"Perhaps, but what is it you require of me?" asked Fabius. "You did not escort me here personally without reason."
"Correct, Apothecary," said Eidolon, placing his hand on Fabius's shoulder guard and leading him deeper into the secret laboratory. "Fulgrim has told me the scale of what you are to attempt, and though I do not approve of your methods, I will obey my Primarch in all things."
"Even in undertaking peacekeeping missions?" asked Fabius.
"Even so," agreed Eidolon, "but I shall not be put in a position where I shall be made to suffer such indignities again. The work you are doing will enhance the physiology of the Astartes, will it not?"
"I believe so. I have only just begun to unlock the mystery of the gene seed, but when I do, I will know all its secrets."
"Then upon my return to the fleet, you will begin with me," said Eidolon. "I shall become your greatest success, faster, stronger, and more deadly than ever before, and I shall become the indispensable right hand of our Primarch. Begin your work here, Apothecary, and I shall see to it that you have everything you need brought to you."
Fabius smiled at the memory, knowing that Eidolon would be pleased with his results when he rejoined the fleet once again. He leaned over the corpse of an Astartes warrior, his surgical robe stained with the cadaver's blood and his portable chirurgeon kit fitted to a servo harness at his waist. Clicking steel arms like metal spider legs reached over his shoulders, each bearing syringes, scalpels, and bone saws that assisted with the dissection and organ removal. The stench of blood and cauterized flesh filled his nostrils, but such things did not repulse Fabius, for they spoke of thrilling discoveries and journeys into the unknown reaches of forbidden knowledge. The cold lights of the apothecarian bleached the corpse's skin and reflected from the incubation tanks he had set up to mature the altered gene seed through chemical stimulation, genetic manipulation, and controlled irradiation. The warrior on the slab had been on the brink of death when he had been brought to the apothecarian, but he had died in bliss with his cerebral cortex exposed, as Fabius had taken advantage of his imminent demise to work within its pulpy grey mass in order to better understand the workings of a living Astartes brain. Inadvertently, Fabius had uncovered the means of linking the nervous system with the pleasure centres of the brain, thus rendering each painful incision a joyous sensation of unalloyed delight. Quite what this discovery might mean to his researches, he wasn't sure, but it was yet another fascinating nugget of information to store away for future experiments. Thus far, Fabius had met with more failures than successes, though the balance was gradually shifting towards the positive now that the war on Laren had provided him with a ready source of gene seed upon which to experiment. The furnaces of the apothecarian had burned day and night, disposing of the waste of his failed experiments, but these blows to progress were necessary for his and the Emperor's children's pursuit of perfection. He knew there were those in the Legion who would recoil from the work he was doing, but they were without vision and could not see the great things he would achieve, the necessary evils that must be endured to reach perfection. By taking the next step in the Astartes' evolutionary journey, Fulgrim's Legion would become the greatest warriors of the Emperor's armies, and the name of Fabius would be celebrated the length and breadth of the Imperium as the chief architect of this elevation. Even now, the apothecarian's incubation tanks held the nascent fruits of his experiments, tiny, budding organs floating in a nutrient-rich suspension. The tissue samples were from Astartes, who had fallen on Laren, and Fabius predicted that his enhancements should double their efficiency. Already he was growing a superior os modular that would increase the strength of the epiphyseal fusion and ossification of a warrior's skeleton, resulting in bones that were virtually unbreakable. Next to the enhanced os modular was a test organ that combined elements of Lair hormones, which, if successful, would alter the fundamental nature of the Betcher's gland, allowing an Astartes to replicate the sonic shriek of the Lair, with devastating results. Work on refining other organs was only just beginning, but Fabius had high hopes for his work on enhancing the Biscopia to stimulate muscle growth beyond the norms and produce warriors as strong as dreadnoughts who could punch through the side of a tank with their bare fists. The multispectral eyes of the Lair had provided a great deal of information he hoped to incorporate into the experiments he had begun on the oculobe. Scores of eyeballs were pinned like butterflies in the sterile cabinets beside him, chemical stimulants working to enhance the capabilities of the optic nerves. With some modification, Fabius believed he could create visual organs that would function at peak efficiency in total darkness, bright light, or stroboscopic conditions, rendering an Astartes effectively immune to being blinded or disorientated. His first success sat behind him on steel shelves in thousands of vials of blue liquid, a drug he had synthesized from a genetic splice between a gland taken from the Lair that replicated the functions of the thyroid gland and the Biscopia. In the test subjects, those warriors wounded too badly to survive, Fabius had found that their metabolism and strength had increased markedly before their deaths. Refinement of the drug had kept the increases from overloading the recipient's heart, and now it was ready for distribution to the Legion en masse. Fulgrim had authorized the use of the drug, and within days it would be coursing through the blood of every warrior who chose to take it. Fabius straightened from the dead body before him and smiled at the thought of the wonders he could create now that he had a free hand in turning his genius to improving the physical stature of the Emperor's children. "Yes," he hissed, his dark eyes alight with the prospect of unlocking the secrets of the Emperor's work. "I will know your secrets." The colours on the palette swirled before Serena's eyes, and the blandness of them infuriated her beyond measure. She had spent the best part of the morning attempting to create the red of the sunset she had seen on Laren, but the emptied pots of paint and broken brushes scattered around her bore mute testament to her failure. The canvas before her was a mess of frantic pencil strokes, the outline of a painting that she was sure would be her greatest work, if only she could get this red to mix properly. "Damn you!" she shouted, and hurled the palette away with such force that it smashed to splinters on the wall. Her breath came in short, painful gasps as the frustration built within her. Serena put her head in her hands and tears came on the heels of hard, racking sobs that hurt her chest. The anger at her failure surged through her body, and she snatched up the broken stem of a paintbrush and pressed the jagged edge of wood into the soft skin of her upper arm. The pain was intense, but at least she could feel it. The skin broke, and blood welled around the splintered wood, bringing her a measure of relief. Only the pain made anything real, and Serena ground the wood deeper into her flesh, watching as the blood ran down her arm over the pale ridges of her older scars. Long dark hair hung in lank ribbons to Serena's waist, stained with spots of colour, and her skin had the unhealthy pallor of one who had not slept in days. Her eyes were bloodshot and grainy, her fingernails cracked and encrusted with paint. Her studio had been turned upside down since she had returned from the surface of Laren. It was not vandalism that had brought about such a transformation, but a frenzied passion to create that had reduced her once immaculate studio to something that resembled the aftermath of a battle. The desire to paint had been like an elemental force within her that could not be denied. It had been thrilling and a little bit frightening. The burning need to create art of passion and sensuality. Serena had filled 3 canvases with colour and light, painting like a woman possessed, before exhaustion had claimed her and she had fallen asleep in the ruin of her studio. When she had awoken, she had looked at what she had painted with a critical eye, seeing the crudity of the work and the primitive colours that had none of the life and urgency she remembered from the temple. Serena had dug through the disarray of her studio for the Picts she had taken of the temple and the mighty coral city, its gloriously masculine towers and wondrously hued skies and ocean. For days she had tried to rekindle the rapturous sensations that had filled her on Laren. But no matter what proportions she mixed her paints in, she could not achieve the tonal qualities she sought. Serena cast her mind back to Laren, remembering the sorrow she had felt when Ostian had been denied a place in the craft travelling to the planet's surface. Guiltily, that sorrow had vanished when they had broken the cloud cover and she had seen the vast blue expanse of the oceans of Laren spread before her. She had never seen such a glorious, vivid blue, and had snapped a dozen Picts before they had even begun their descent towards the Laer Atoll. Circling the floating city had stirred feelings within her that she hadn't known existed, and Serena had ached to set foot on its alien structure more than anything. Upon landing, they had been escorted through the broken ruins of the city, every one of the remembrancers staring open-mouthed at the wonderful otherness of it all. Captain Julius had explained that the tall conch towers had screamed all through the war, though all but a handful were now silenced, brought down by explosives to render them mute. The few ululating screams Serena could hear sounded impossibly distant, achingly lonely, and infinitely sad. Serena had taken Pict after Pict as they were led through the wreckage of battle, and even the torn corpses of the Laer could not detract from the thrill of walking on a city that floated above the ocean. The sights and colours were so vibrant that she couldn't take it all in, her senses stimulated to the point of overload. Then she had seen the temple. All thoughts other than achieving entry to its mysterious interior were banished from her mind as Captain Julius and the iterators had led the way towards the towering structure. A hungry, intense determination had seized the remembrancers, and they made their way towards the temple with unseemly haste. Picking their way through the rubble, she had smelled the strange, smoky aroma of what she had at first thought to be incense, burnt by the army units to mask the stench of blood and death. Then she saw the ghostly wisps of pink mist seeping from the porous walls of the temple, and realized that it was something of alien origin. A delicious momentary panic filled her until she smelled more of the strange musk and decided that it was quite pleasant. Arc lights had been set up inside the cave-like entrance of the temple, and the brilliant glow illuminated wondrous colours and murals of such lifelike imagery that they took her breath away. Gasps of astonishment came from all around her as artists attempted to capture the scale of the murals and imagists took panoramic pics of the scene. From somewhere inside, Serena could hear music. Wild, passionate music that lodged like a splinter in her heart. She turned from the murals, following the blue hair of Bequa, as the siren song of the music grew louder and drew them both onwards. From nowhere, her anger at Bequa suddenly pounded hot in her veins, and she felt her lip curl back in a snarl. Serena set off after Bequa, the music of the temple swelling within her the deeper she went. Though she was conscious of people around her, Serena paid them no mind, her thoughts filled with the sensations flooding her system. Music, light and colour were all around her, and she put a hand out to steady herself as the sheer excessiveness of it all threatened to overwhelm her. Serena pushed herself onwards, rounded a corner into the temple's interior, and dropped to her knees as she saw terrifying beauty and awesome energy in the lights and noise of the temple. Bequa Kinska stood in the middle of the great space, her arms raised in a V, as she held up the wands of a vox thief, and the music poured over her. Serena thought she'd never seen anything so beautiful in all her life. Her eyes burned with colour, and it had been all she could do not to weep at its perfection. Now, back in her studio, she had spent all her energies trying to recapture that brief, shining moment of perfect colour without success. Straightening her back and wiping her tears on her sleeve, she picked up another palette from the detritus strewn around her and began mixing her paints to try, once again, to capture it. She mixed cadmium red with quinacridone crimson, leavening the red with some perylene maroon, but already she could see that the colours weren't quite right, the tone off by a fraction. Even as her anger built again, a droplet of blood fell from her arm into the paint as she was mixing it, and suddenly there it was. The colour was perfect, and she smiled, understanding what she had to do. Serena picked up the small knife she used for cutting the nibs of her quills and drew the blade across her skin, cutting into the soft flesh above her elbow. Droplets of blood fell from the cut, and she held the palette beneath it, smiling as she saw the colours forming. Now she could begin painting. Solomon ducked beneath the swinging cut of a sword, bringing his own weapon up in time to block the reverse cut to his chest. The blow rang up the length of his arm, and he gritted his teeth as his freshly healed bones protested at the rigours he was putting them through. He backed away from Marius as the captain of the third came at him again with his sword aimed at his heart. "You are slow, Solomon," said Marius. Solomon swept his sword down, pushing aside the clumsy thrust, and spun to deliver the death blow to his opponent, but pulled up short as Marius's blade clove towards him. He twisted out of the way, his body feeling as if it was coming apart at the seams. "Fast enough to see you coming, old man," laughed Solomon, though he knew it was only a matter of time before Marius wore him down. "You're lying," noted Marius, throwing his sword down to the mat. He backed towards the racks of weapons that lined the walls of the training hall and selected a pair of sun and moon spear blades. The double-headed daggers were impractical in a real fight, but made for a deadly training weapon. Solomon threw aside his own sword and picked up a pair of wind and fire wheels. Like his opponent's weapons, these too were largely decorative, the circular blade held by a textured grip and embellished with curved punch spikes around its circumference. But Solomon enjoyed training with weapons that were beyond his normal range. He faced Marius and extended his left arm, while keeping his right hooked at his side. "Maybe I am, maybe I'm not," grinned Solomon. "There's only one way to find out." Marius nodded and stormed towards him, the twin-bladed daggers spinning before him in a web of glittering steel. Solomon blocked first one strike, then another, each ringing clang, forcing him back towards the wall. He swayed aside from a high, slashing cut and sent a low, sweeping blow towards Marius's legs. Marius stabbed one of his daggers down, the tip lancing through the centre of the circular weapon and pinning it to the floor. Solomon jumped back, forced to leave it behind, as the second blade was thrust towards him. "Have you heard the news?" gasped Solomon, desperate to distract Marius and buy himself some space. "What news?" asked Marius.
"That we're to be issued some new chemical stimulant for testing," said Solomon.
"I'd heard, yes," nodded Marius. "The Primarch believes it will make us stronger and faster than ever."
Solomon frowned at his friend's tone, the words sounding as though he was speaking them by rote, but didn't really believe them. Solomon paused in his retreat and said,
"Aren't you a little bit concerned at where it came from?"
"It comes from the Primarch," said Marius, putting up his dagger.
"No, I mean the drug. It hasn't come from Terra, I know that much," said Solomon. "In fact, I think it was made right here. I heard Apothecary Fabia say something about it before he transferred to the Andronius."
"What difference does it make where it comes from?" asked Marius. "The Primarch has authorized its use for those that wish it."
"I'm not sure," admitted Solomon, as Marius began to circle him. "Perhaps none at all, but I just don't like the idea of some new chemical being pumped into me when I don't know where it came from."
Marius laughed and said, "All the genetic enhancements done to your flesh in the laboratory, and you choose now to worry about chemicals in your body?"
"It's not the same thing, Marius. We were created in the image of the Emperor as his perfect warriors. So why do we need more?"
Marius shrugged and lunged with his dagger. Solomon swatted it away with his remaining weapon and groaned in pain as he felt something tear inside. The bout was over. Deciding that his mind would break before his body would heal, he had removed himself from the apothecarian and returned to his company's arming chambers. Gaius Cafan had been pleased to see him, but Solomon could tell that his subordinate had enjoyed the brief taste of command and knew that he would need to see about getting him his own company. As the days passed with no sign of the Diasporex, he had trained fiercely to rebuild his strength and had taken to visiting Marius Verosian for grueling sparring matches, none of which he had the strength to win.
"Fulgrim has said we should do so," said Marius, as if that were an end to the matter.
"He has, but I still don't like it," gasped Solomon. "I just can't see why it's needed."
"What you see or don't see is irrelevant," said Marius. "The word has been given, and we are duty-bound to obey. Our ideal of perfection and purity comes from Fulgrim, and it passes down through the Lord Commanders to us, the company captains, whereupon it is beholden to us to enact the Primarch's will amongst our warriors."
"I know all that, but this just feels wrong," said Solomon, breathing heavily and tossing his dagger to the floor. "Enough. I'm done. You win."
Marius nodded and said,
"You are getting stronger every day, Solomon."
"Not strong enough," said Solomon, slumping to his haunches on the training mat.
"No, not yet, but your strength will return soon enough, and then perhaps you'll give me a decent fight," replied Marius, sitting down next to him.
"Don't you worry about that," promised Solomon. "I'll have you beaten soon enough."
"You won't," replied Marius, without irony. "I've been training the third harder than ever before, and we're at our very best. I'm at my very best, and with this new chemical, I'll be even faster and stronger."
Solomon looked into his friend's eyes and saw the desperate yearning to atone for his failure on the atoll. He reached out and placed his hand on Marius's arm.
"Listen, I know you know this already, but I'm going to say it anyway," he said.
"No,"
said Marius, shaking his head.
"Don't. The third were shamed, and you will only make it worse if you try and excuse our failure."
"It wasn't a failure," said Solomon.
"Yes, it was," nodded Marius. "If you can't see that, then perhaps you were lucky to have been shot down before you got there."
Solomon felt his collar rise and said,
"Lucky? I almost died."
"It would be easier if I had died," whispered Marius.
"You don't mean that."
"Perhaps not.
But the fact remains that the third failed in its appointed task, and until we atone for that, I will ensure that my company follows the Primarch's orders without question.
No matter what they are? Asked Solomon.
Exactly, said Marius. No matter what they are.